Hej! Hej! Thank you so much for accepting my invitation to have lunch with me today. Yes, you, the one listening to this episode. There's no guest today, just me and you, and it's because I don't want to confine this topic to the perspective of one person. In fact, this episode is actually going to leave you with more questions than answers. But I think it's important that we explore these questions anyway, even though we might not necessarily reach any solid conclusions. I want to talk about something very, very tricky. I want to talk about the nature of belief. Why do we believe? It's very easy to take this question for granted because the answer seems like common sense. But I'm not asking why me and you believe in African spirituality or why someone else believes in Christianity or the related justifications, but I want to understand belief as a human capacity. I have been going back and forth with myself about whether or not to even do this topic because it can get very complex and extremely abstract very quickly, and we could get lost down a nonsensical rabbit hole where we are just using big words to say rubbish. So I need you to bear with me, and I will try to keep it as simple as possible. I've already ordered my food. It's a burger and chips, so you can go ahead and order whatever you like. I'm actually going to add a side of Ever to mine. It's gonna come in handy in the conversation later on. Now, to explain what I mean about what is the nature of belief, I can use this meal as an example. Before deciding to have this meal, my body sent certain signals to my brain that nutrients and fuel are running low, right? My brain then brought it to my conscious attention that I need to eat. It's my digestive system talking to my endocrine system, talking to my nervous system, and then talking to my muscular system. That is the nature of these systems of my body as a human being. And their function is that once I come into being, they need to keep me alive for as long as they possibly can. In order to have this meal, I had to talk to the waitress and tell her what it is that I wanted. This is language. Language evolved out of our need to express ourselves and to convey information from one person to another person or a group. So the nature of language is to connect individuals to each other and their larger groups. So in that manner of thinking, what is the nature of belief? When I hold a certain belief, what is it that is happening within me? And what is the function of the system within the broader experience of being human? In episode 7, I dealt with the scientific basis of how spirituality can exist. In that episode, I also explored the concept of how spirituality evolved from ancient man's need to make sense of a seemingly terrifying vastness of the world around him. But what I want to know right now is, why do I have the capacity to believe or hold a belief? Now, let's start with the basics. My meal has Evo in it. I love Evos, like I absolutely love Evos. And I could put Evo in just about anything. But the one thing I really, really hate is olives. Olives taste like something that's supposed to kill you, like something that hunters put on their arrows to poison animals before bringing them down. But here's the odd thing. I don't know why I love avocados. Yes, I love the taste, but I don't know why I love the taste. Similarly, I don't know why I hate olives. I don't know why I hate the taste, yet someone else finds them delicious. And what I mean by these is, I didn't decide to love avocados. And if you love olives and hate avocados, you also didn't decide that. It is just something that you discovered about yourself. It sort of came built in into your system. So my question is, what is that system? Also, I love the color orange, but I don't like green. And I could go on and on, but these are minor. So let's talk about something a bit more complicated. Let's talk about love. You don't choose who you love. Yes, you love the person that you love, and you love the feeling that you get from it. But this is not a process that you initiate consciously. Sure, you can say that you love a person with a great smile or a great personality or a great sense of humor, and you love people who are caring. But it's very possible that you can also fall madly and deeply in love with someone who has none of these qualities. And this is why umjolo has you by the washing. The list of requirements that you have is a kind of belief that you hold about yourself. And yet, something in you decides who you fall in love with. And that something is not you. Love is one of the most fundamental of all human experiences. It is something that every single one of us deeply, deeply yearns for. And connecting with love gives our lives meaning and purpose in such a profound way. Yet, it is not in our control. And again, you can choose who you date, or you can choose who you hang out with. But you don't get to choose who you truly, truly love. Materialism says that love is just a series of chemical reactions, and in fact, everything about us, according to science, is just a bunch of chemical reactions and electrical impulses. But when it comes to love, something in you has decided that it is through being in contact with a particular person, a specific person, that these chemical reactions will be set into motion. On the other hand, psychology will tell you that your preferences can be traced back to your childhood or some form of conditioning, and that ultimately your biological system is geared towards survival, that is equated with a feeling of safety and security. And by extension, we fall for the people that we subconsciously feel that they offer us safety and security in whatever form that we define it as. But have you ever been in love? Like, have you ever been truly in love, deeply and sincerely and frighteningly in love? If you have, then you will know that in that moment, you actually don't need anything from that person. Not safety, not security. It is not a series of needs that are met, but it is almost like a state of being, a profound sense of contentment. It is difficult for a lot of people to imagine this kind of feeling, because we live in a world where we talk about how love is not enough, and what are you bringing to the table, and how I want this from a partner, and I want that from a partner, and I want. It's a transactional system of relationships, born out of a system that bases our value on what we can provide. That's not the love that I'm talking about. But nonetheless, conditioning plays a big part in how we construct our beliefs. For example, I am a black man, and that implies certain things. Biologically, it implies that I am physically stronger than the average woman. And this, socially, implies that I must offer protection and provision. It is virtually built into our DNA, right? So let us look at the belief that the man is the provider. Let's look at our history as black people. Who did your great grandfather work for? Before he moved to the cities to work in the mines, what was his job? And who paid his salary that he took home? Think about it for a minute. When your great-grandfather wanted to get married, The cows that he used to pay Lobola came from his father. At the time, there were no jobs, there were no salaries, just homesteads. And what do you think that your great-grandmother did the whole day? You probably think that she stayed home with the kids. That's only partly true. In many African cultures, when a woman is married, she is given her own plot of land on which to farm produce. So, in all likelihood, your great-grandmother had her own plot of land which she worked to grow food. When your great-grandfather brought home the meat, your great-grandmother brought home the pap, which she planted, harvested, and processed and cooked herself. There was an entire system of provision that equally relied on men and women for the survival of the family. So the concept of the man as the sole provider came with the colonizers when they wanted to add a kind of a poetic nobility to forcing men to leave their homes to go work in the mines, and most importantly, leaving women disempowered and marginalized. It is not genetics. It's capitalism. But then again, be that as it may, regardless of socioeconomics, I'm still a man, and there are certain beliefs that I hold about myself, and one of them is my attraction towards women. And here is where social conditioning gets a bit tricky. On the one hand, I'm almost certainly sexually attracted to women. And I think it's safe to say that this is definitely genetic. I mean, we as mammals do need to procreate in order for the human race to continue existing. And the only way that we can naturally do this is for a man and a woman to have sexual intercourse. What is helpful for me in this regard and keeping this mindset is that my social conditioning affirms this. I believe this about me, and the society that I live in believes this about me too. So then, let us talk about queerness. Oh, and if you don't believe in the legitimacy of the existence of the LGBTQ+ community, I'm going to tell you why you believe this in a minute. So, queerness in many ways goes against social conditioning. As the spectrum grows wider and wider, it destabilizes more and more of what we feel is our social conditioning that dictates that a man is this and a woman is that, and what kind of relationship that these two should have. But now, scientifically speaking, there is no gay gene, right? Scientists have not found any genetic evidence of gayness. Obviously, this excludes intersex people. So, genetically, me and a gay man are pretty much genetically similar. So, which part of him is gay? Which part of him is triggering the same chemical reactions when he encounters an attractive man that I experience when I encounter an attractive woman? Remember that I don't have control over who I'm attracted to, right? So where is his gayness situated? And even more importantly, where is my heterosexuality located? This is what scares people who are homophobic. The fact that queerness throws genetics out the window. This is why we want to say that queerness is a choice and heterosexuality is not, because the implications of this not being the case are terrifying to most people. So there's this thing that we do when we talk about the LGBTQ+ community, when the topic comes up, where we want to strip queer relationships of love and affection and companionship, and we want to strip it down to just it being about sexual intercourse, and we are unnerved by what our imagination tells us happens. Well, except for lesbians. Somehow, we're cool with lesbian sex. For the sake of the topic, let's talk about sexual intercourse. Say you, a cis heterosexual man or woman, come across your type. You know, the one who turns you on. You have a type, right? I mean, you don't just get turned on by anyone. So you come across this sexy specimen of a person who ticks all of your boxes, and you feel the rush of blood throughout your whole body, right down to your little giblets. Did you decide what your type is? No. You just know that when you see it. Did you decide on the boxes that they should tick in order for you to get turned on? No. you just found yourself getting excited when a person who does tick those particular boxes walks across you. Did you initiate the exciting rush of blood to your nether regions? That is also not the case. No, you didn't. It just kind of happens on its own, and all you care about is that it feels really, really nice. But somehow, we believe that queer folk have control over this entire process just because they have decided that they can. Maybe you think that queerness is some kind of mental illness, a sickness. And then I would want to ask, what kind of mental illness compels a person to want to grow up and find a fulfilling career and meet someone that they love and have a long-lasting and caring relationship with that person and possibly even have a family, just so that they can live the best of their lives and grow old together and die peacefully in their sleep surrounded by family and friends? What kind of mental illness is that? Or maybe you are religious and you believe that queerness is some kind of demon. And then I would want to ask what a demon is actually made of. But then again, I would be getting ahead of myself. Okay, so maybe you reckon that all of this talk is about bodily functions and has nothing to do with the question at hand of what is the nature of belief and why do we believe in what we believe in. So let's talk about what we call natural gifts, our talents. When we say that a person is gifted or talented in something, there is an understanding that something deep inside that person connects with this particular activity. And generally speaking, this talent is not necessarily connected to your conditioning. And I mean, you can grow up in a soccer-obsessed family and totally suck at playing soccer. And you can come from a family that has no musical interest at all, and you become a music icon. Something in you decided that this is the one activity that you will excel at and put in place the correct kinds of neural connections and the necessary chemical reactions that will allow you to perform much better than other people at this particular activity. Yes, hard work goes a very long way, but no one can make themselves talented. You can't make yourself gifted in any form. That is somehow predetermined for you. Speaking of talent, there's this thing called the flow state. It is basically defined as the mental state in which a person performing some activity is fully immersed in a feeling of energized focus, full involvement, and enjoyment in the process of that activity. It is essentially what we call being in the zone and is very common amongst athletes and artists when a person is so in tune with what they are doing that in that moment, the world around them basically just disappears. Now, this is the crucial part. In that moment, the world falls away and every fiber in that person's being knows what it has to do without even the person thinking about it. As a creative, this is something that I have experienced. It is as though you become the gift itself. Who you are disappears, and in that moment, time and space disappear. And they disappear to such an extent that when the moment ends, it feels like you were somewhere else, in a different place, in a different time. So then the question is, where is this somewhere else? Is it a place? And what kind of place is it? Because if you get to this place through being deeply connected with what you're gifted at, by being deeply connected with what you love, then is this the place or the thing that decides what it is that you love? I don't know if you've noticed, but now we have left the world of bodily functions. Now we're in the realm of consciousness. In 2005, the American scientific publication released for its 125th issue the 25 top unanswered questions in science. Number 2 on that list was the hard question of what is consciousness? For the fact that this question is showing scientists flames means that there is no way I will be able to explain it on this meager podcast of mine. But my aim is not to define it, but rather to understand our relationship with it. For the average person like you and me, our general understanding of consciousness is that it is our awareness of ourselves and the world around us. But what is less clear is what consciousness is in relation to our mind. But I can give you my basic interpretation of this. You see that TV on the wall? Yeah, the one there, the one by the bar. Yeah. Your mind is like the TV. It just projects images onto the screen. Inside it, there is nothing but electronic components. The soccer match is not happening inside the TV. There is a place where the match and every other thing that you see on TV is happening. That is your consciousness. So here the question is, how much control do I have over my consciousness, or how much control does my consciousness have over me? This is important because I believe that it impacts on how we engage with what we believe and our capacity to believe. But I cannot answer this question. There's absolutely no way. And I know that a lot of Eastern traditions talk about this, but I haven't quite understood it in a way that I can explain it to anyone. So I wish you well in digging further. There is, however, an even deeper question. And that is far more important, I think. And that is, what is the relationship between my consciousness and my soul? I think that most of us have a basic understanding of what a soul is, right? Or what do you believe a soul is? Like, think about it. A quick Google search says, the spiritual or immaterial part of a human being or animal regarded as immortal, right? The spiritual or immaterial part of a human being or animal regarded as immortal. At this point of our conversation, this really doesn't help much. But it does mention something very important, and that is the association of the soul with spirituality. We tend to believe that our soul, in spiritual terms, is that part of us that is divine. It's like a little ghost baby tucked away somewhere in our insides. So now, here's a question for you, a believer of African spirituality. What is Ilozi? Is it the ascended consciousness of a deceased person, or is it their soul? You'll probably say soul, right? But now, when you say uhamba nabo gogo nabo mkhulu, you are already talking in gender terms. And often you will even hear people describe the personalities of the people that they work with. Like, ugogo is moody, or umkhulu is quick to anger, or this umkhulu likes milk stout or BB, this gogo likes snaif, or whatever. That, to me, sounds like a person's consciousness, because it describes personality traits and preferences. I can ask a similar question to Christians. Which part of you is going to heaven or hell? Is it your consciousness or is it your soul? Speaking of hell, which part of you has sinned? You could say that it's your mind, but your mind just processes data. And then you hear about things like sins of the flesh. But in reality, however, your flesh just wants nutrients and water, not Pornhub. So which part is sinning and which part is it sinning against? Does the soul have any control over this whole process? I honestly don't know. And with Christianity comes the question of the difference between soul and spirit. And I'm not a Christian, so I'm going to exit this part right here. There's a kind of universality to the concept of the soul. Like, there's a perception that we all have the same type of soul, yet our consciousnesses are vastly different. So, does a soul have an individual identity? Like, is it possible for your soul to have a name, a distinct identity from all the other souls that will then dictate its preferences or what it is that it wants or doesn't want, which then informs what you want and what you don't want. Is the soul an active entity in your life, or is it a passive one? Like, does it guide you to the person that you love, or does it just react when you meet them? Regardless of the definitions, I think intuitively we know that there is a higher aspect to who we are. It does get tricky as to who you actually is, but our experience with love and connecting with something like what you believe is your life's purpose, that's something that gives us a glimpse into that higher aspect. We call it a soul because I don't think we actually have a word in any language that can fully capture what this essence is, in pretty much the same way that no human language can encompass who or what God is. What I mean is, the word flower is not a flower. The word beauty does not encompass what you see in the eyes of the one that you love. But the idea of the soul does seem to draw us towards something deeper and something bigger. And it does this while the concept of consciousness anchors us in the here and the now. And this takes us back to the concept of the flow state, or being in the zone. When the time and space disappear when you're connecting with your gift, that is the moment in which your consciousness disappears. That is when you disappear as a person, or as your own understanding of your consciousness, because it is our consciousness that anchors us in the here and the now. Because without our consciousness, you wouldn't have any awareness of time or space. So this is where these questions and these thoughts have brought me. They've brought me to an understanding that belief is the gravitational force that links our consciousness to our soul. We believe because there is something in us that compels us to yearn for something beyond just our bodily functions. The question of your life's purpose is not a question of survival. It is a question of transcendence. We have in us the capacity to believe, and for me, I think this capacity came before the objects of our beliefs. A Christian in church and an atheist climbing Mount Everest are both searching for the same thing. It can go by many different names, but intuitively, deep down inside, we know that those two people are looking for the same thing, be it in this moment or the next moment or the moment after you die. Or maybe you're an atheist and you're calling out BS on my part. Maybe you reckon that I'm making inferences based on my cognitive lean towards confirmation bias. And you know what? I cannot prove you wrong. The beef between science and spirituality boils down to two things. One is the question of morality, and two is the question of proof. The way spirituality is taught is that existence is based around the concept of good and evil, and science says that the universe is not built around good or evil, it is built around the objective laws of science and biology. I blame organized religion for this because since medieval times, the church has always tried to enforce its lust for power by using morality as the basis of life, simply because it could control what morality was or wasn't. But the basis of the existence of the spiritual realm is not premised on morality. The spiritual realm exists because it exists, in exactly the same way that the scientific view of the universe is that the universe exists because it exists. The existence of illos is not based on good or bad. Just like the human experience, the spiritual realm is a complex system whose nature we can't fully understand, in the same way as science can't fully explain how life came about and what the purpose of this whole entire existence actually is. Which leads us to the second question of proof. The premise of the principle of proof is that if something cannot be scientifically proven in a way that fits the human understanding and cognition, then that something cannot exist or be true. This view is as naive as the early church's insistence that the earth is the center of the universe. So I've told you about the second unanswered question in science, which is, what is consciousness? Now, the principle of proof is challenged by the number one unanswered question in science, and that is, what is the universe made of? Here, scientists have conceded that science can only account for 5% of the universe. All of the laws and all of the language and all of our understanding of the universe only explains 5% of what is happening in the observable universe. Not only is the rest of the 95% unknown, but it also defies the very laws that science are based on. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle states that there is a fundamental limit to what one can know about the quantum system. And a quantum system is basically the very fabric of what we believe existence is, scientifically speaking. Simply put, what this uncertainty principle says is that there is a line which we will never cross in our scientific understanding of life, because this line calls for something that science cannot do, and that is to take as a matter of fact that something can exist and not exist at the same time. But please understand me, I am not saying that what lies outside the bounds of science is spirituality. What I am saying is that the word spirituality does not even begin to scratch the surface of what actually lies out there. Nonetheless, we will call it spirituality because we don't know what else to say. So, let's say this restaurant that we're sitting in is spirituality. Over there in that table is a group of friends. They are here because this place helps them to bond with each other. Then there's that family over there, there by the window. It's a strict and stern family, you can see by the father. This place gives them as a family a sense of stability in their lives, a sense of order. Then there's that one over there waiting for his date. He believes that bringing someone here is his highest expression of love. Then there's that vegan over there. She hates everyone who eats a burger. Then there's that guy, the big shot. He believes that being here helps him with accumulation of wealth. Then there's that lady over there having coffee by herself. She's a foodie. She's in the restaurant because she believes she understands this place better than anyone. She's the expert. We are all here for many different reasons, with our different tastes and preferences. But nonetheless, we are somehow physiologically built to be here. We are physiologically built to believe. I know this is confusing metaphysics, but I don't think that you know who you really are, what you really are. Think about it. Beyond your memories, who are you? Beyond your thought processes, what are you? What is your purpose here? Materialism says that the notion of purpose is just a naive human construct to make ourselves feel better, because somehow we are terrified of the possibility that there really is no point to any of this. And it is because of this fear that we have created this whole idea of God. I personally can't prove them wrong. But the answers to these lie far outside of our collective comprehension, and lots of things about spirituality and soul and spirit and life may be out of our comprehension and out of our control. But I think that belief really is a bridge between us and our highest selves. I may not know who I am or what I am, but I believe. I believe in compassion. I believe in love, and I believe love is the most beautiful thing that you can ever hope to experience in this life. Is this science? Is it spirituality? I really don't know. It's hard to say. But I do know, without a shadow of a doubt, what I have experienced beyond my biological senses. I know, without a shadow of a doubt, that I have experienced divinity and divine guidance in the form of my ancestors in ways that, despite my own efforts, I cannot rationalize away as some kind of evolutionary fear of annihilation or that they may not be a point to my life. There are things in this world that the human language and the human experience cannot even begin to comprehend. And if all that we know and can express is literally 5% of what could possibly be out there, what lies in the rest of the 95%? I believe it's going to take many lifetimes in order to answer these questions. But the big question now between me and you is, who's paying the bill?